Okay, have a seat. Thought this would be a little more comfortable. You all right there, Mr. Rickett?
I'm fine.
You sure you don't want an attorney?
I'm sure.
Okay, we're going to start in a few minutes when the case detective gets here. In the meantime, you can relax. You want anything like a soda, coffee? Hey, you want to look at the sports section? We might be here for a bit. I was never much into sports. My high school basketball coach said I looked like a retarded gazelle with a spastic disorder. Mr. Daly, real loving guy. You look like you're in pretty good shape. You work out, Mr. Rickett? I've been thinking about getting a trainer myself. You know, bulking up a little bit. I think it might help me with the ladies. Is that why you work out?
City, sexually based offenses are considered especially heinous. These are their stories.
Hey guys, welcome to Munch My Benson. My name is Adam. It is approximately 10 minutes since the last time we spoke, but 1 week since the last time you heard our voices. I'm still doing okay. It's a night in New York. I am joined on the line by Josh, who is still in a basement in the Twin Cities. Now, I did preserve a little bit of banter. Let's see. So I watched the newest Charlie Kaufman film the other day, which is I'm Thinking of Ending It, I think is what it's called.
Yep.
I would say that this is a movie that made me feel like I needed to do homework to understand what was going on.
I felt like that was Synecdoche, too.
Yeah, it was cool and very interesting, and Toni Collette in particular I think is awesome, is fantastic in it.
Not a rare thing, because she's generally pretty fantastic.
Yeah, no, she's great. Yeah, she was also great in Knives Out.
Yeah.
But man, is it obtuse and confounding. it is something you're watching like, what the fuck am I watching? And should I have been taking more notes when I was reading the fucking David Foster Wallace series of essays that I never read?
Yeah.
Anyways, I do recommend it, but just go in knowing that it's a lot. It's a lot.
Right. Well, as we mentioned, I saw Pig.
Nice.
I don't want to say too much about it because I think people should go in blind.
Okay.
But it is really fucking great. I say this without the whole Nick Cage, you know, obviously I love Nick Cage, you know, I wouldn't have.
As you should. Yeah.
Wouldn't have talked about him in my only day on Jeopardy had I not had strong feelings for Nicolas Cage. I sincerely and deeply love the man.
I love Season of a Witch almost as much as I love, you know, Leaving Las Vegas. It's like.
Sure.
I love High. I love Low. Mm-hmm. I love it all.
But there's a reason this one is in the high 90s on Rotten Tomato. When we went, it was 98 on Rotten Tomatoes, and I think it's down to 97 or 96.
I mean, I don't know if it's Oscar buzz, but definitely the press around it is like, Nick Cage, the greatest actor of his generation.
I mean, and they're not wrong.
Yeah, I completely agree. And yeah. I love the fact that he doesn't fuck around with his reputation. He wants to act. He doesn't care that he like invested in some shady real estate scheme that lost
more money than he'll
ever see. Uh-huh. I love that about him. And I love that he'll take any fucking movie and just and do it.
Mm-hmm.
He drives angry, Josh. He
does. Yeah. I saw it in the theater along with another 10 movies around it in a row.
He's a national treasure, and we're going to miss him when he finally...
And he's the star of that series, and I would gladly watch another were they to do a third.
Absolutely. Another thing that I've got going on is that... So I kind of mentioned it, and I think it was... Well, now, at this point, 2 weeks ago, there was kind of a weird fight that I heard in the middle of the night.
Yes.
Well, there's been updates with that. So it turns out that there's one of the apartments in my building. They're squatters. And I don't know the details. It's been a hold on evictions, right, since the pandemic, sure. Which might have just lapsed. I'm not up on the news, I think.
It did, and this is all despite the fact that Biden could just extended.
Just with a wave of a hand. Now, I don't know the details of what was going on here, but I know that there is a unit where they were supposedly squatting. And I know that Megan and I walked downstairs and there was somebody who looked as sketchy as you could possibly look sitting in the middle of our very narrow stairway. And we had to like edge around them. We're talking full on black hoodie with the hood up. It's warm outside. Latex gloves on. Now, I know it's COVID, so it's now, not.
Wait, when you say you had to edge around them.
Like, yeah. <we're>
you two were edging?
Yeah, we were edging. We were building up to a little docking session.
Cool, cool, yeah. Nice. Space docking or normal docking?
Clearly space docking. Anyways, so we see this person. We're like, oh, this is weird, right? Because this was weird. Now, in context, I kind of get it more because we know the person in question's mother, who is also very weird, but jolly and friendly. Anyways, so one of our other neighbors is like, here's the deal. They're squatting. They never had a lease to begin with, and they haven't paid rent in over a year. And I was like, okay, that sounds awesome. But then I think what had happened is the landlord had rekeyed the locks to try to kick them out without kicking them out, because even in normal times, it's hard to evict people in this town.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, long story short, last night we're woken up in the middle of the night by the squatter's locksmith drilling out the locks so that they could get back in. And then in the morning, there were cops all around the place interviewing the landlord, and nobody would answer the door. It's awesome drama. I really can't wait to see where it goes in the long run, but it's been entertaining. Anyways, if you're ready, we should jump into an episode because I'm hoping we can get out of this one quick. I think this might be one of the shorter ones.
I think we'll be able to.
Because not much happens.
Yeah, this is it's a weird one.
Yeah.
This week, our installment of SVU that we're watching is from season 6. It's episode 17, entitled Rage. We open on Stabler setting up an interrogation room to be especially irritating for its soon-to-be subject of questioning, while said subject gives us the straight dope on Stabler via off-screen dialogue given to another suspect in holding, which turns out to be a hooded Finn. When we get eyes on the subject, giving us the setup of the episode via de facto voiceover, it turns out we've got Matthew Modine as this week's big bad. And Cragen asks Elliot how much more time he's got before they release this criminal mastermind. Elliot says they arrested him 3 hours ago, right before he was about to skip town and slip through their fingers again, and we've got ourselves a ticking clock race against time that looks like it might play out entirely in the precinct. Benson starts the full court press, pounding him about the rape, murder, post-mortem mutilation of a preteen girl case that he skated on because all the evidence was circumstantial, and he briefly blows up before whistling a tune, eliciting Elliot's entry into the room. Elliot lays down the new case's details, and they're pretty much a carbon copy of his last suspected victim that Elliot drew. They ask him about California, about his ex-fiance, about California, about his recently deceased aunt, about California, about his garbage man job he just lost, about California, about the bar he used to own, about California, about everyone who doubted him, and about California. He suddenly flips and starts saying he's a psycho killer and he's going to kill their children and their puppies before pulling the plug on the freakout and saying, "Aw, shucks, I was just goofing." You see, Gordon Rickett is a man. He doesn't just sue the city when Elliot throws him through a plate glass window. He's no schmuck. He can control himself. Stabler orders Stinkfood to engage in malodorous psyops. Cragen tries to get Stabler to change up his approach, but Elliot says that he understands this guy, that he gets off on trying to control the rage until he can't take it anymore and finds a young girl to slaughter. They go back into the interrogation, where Stabler's stank-ass dishes waft through the air, and Finn waltzes in to say Gordy ain't punkin' cops, he's getting punked. Then they list all the victims they've linked to him in his travels across California, Nevada, and Arizona. Stabler gets worked up when pressed by Benson about why he doesn't want her in there, and we get a glimpse of Gordy's problems popping up in Elliot. Finn and Elliot take a trip through his childhood, trying to extract a confession from his tortured past. Stabler tells him the court psychiatrist called him a moron, calls him a bitch 117 times, and spits in his face while screaming at him. When Rickett doesn't break, Finn tells Cragen that this was the whole plan, so who knows what happens next. We jump ahead to right about when they're going to have to cut Gordon loose, and Elliot looks to be closing up shop and interrogation, packing it in because they've been bettered once again. Stabler tells Gordon that he's all about two things: annihilation of hope and potential in these girls, and rage, which he thinks he's controlling but is actually controlling him. Gordon tells Stabler this is some pot and kettle ass shit. Stabler agrees that he would be Rickett if all the things tethering him to the world were gone, and Rickett walks out of interrogation a free man. They pore over the lies Rickett told in interrogation and use those to chase down his girlfriend. The girlfriend leads them to a salon near the Vic's home. The salon leads them to a burned-out car on Staten Island near where his aunt lived in assisted living. They go to her unoccupied home, and Gordon has clearly been holed up there to do his dirty work. Rickett waltzes in with his next kill while they're in the basement looking over the blood from his previous victims. They rush upstairs, end up in a standoff with Rickett, who tries to goad Stabler into killing him. Benson wings him in the shoulder, tells Elliot that if she hadn't done that, she knew he'd have killed Rickett and given him exactly what he wanted. Stabler beats the shit out of some lockers, and we get a, they won't let him hump the fridge anymore, so I guess he's gotta fuck up these lockers, Dick Wolf.
I want to thank all of you for a terrific summer. Cooking for all you nice people has really helped me get over the fact that I fought in the Vietnam War. Have a great winter. I'm going to go hump the fridge.
What?
Yes, folks, it's true. I said I'm going to go hump the fridge. What you may not know is I also own a bottle of dick cream I found in my sweaters, and I often like to smear mud on my ass.
Man, this episode, you don't forget it after you watch it, because you don't hear the da-dung and expect to see Matthew Modine sitting in a room for the next 45 minutes. That's not what you sign up for.
Yeah. This seems like another one where, you know, now they've got actors of a certain level.
Yeah.
Where, nah, this is where I'm going to try to get my Emmy. And to be fair, Modine already had one.
Yeah.
And the band played on. But,
Now, I mean, since we don't have...
Or no, he only had a nomination, not a win.
So we can kind of freeform this Modine talk. I guess there's a couple people else to talk about, but I feel like some actors do really well with the stunt casting. You know, I'm thinking, of course, of Andrew McCarthy as probably the standout example.
Sure.
At least the...
Or Stephen Ray's not really stunt casting because he's just a fucking great actor. But Stephen Ray also does a fucking phenomenal job with what he's given.
Yeah, Stephen Ray could have played this role very well. Andrew McCarthy probably could have played this role pretty well, and I think he would have done it in a totally different way, and it would have been over the top and fun.
Yeah.
I like Matthew Modine in many things that he's been in, but I don't think he has the range for this. Like, I don't think that this kind of rage is the kind of rage that Matthew Modine has. What I'm saying, Josh, is he's not blue-collar enough for this role. And there's nothing you can do to make me think that he's blue-collar enough for this role.
But he wore a Western Pearl Snap shirt and a denim jacket.
He did, and he still looked like a fucking yuppie dickhead doing it.
I will say I don't know that he hit the blue-collar part. Okay. I am actually on kind of the opposite side of
you like the Modine
spectrum with you. I don't generally like him.
You don't? Okay. I like him in certain
roles. I actually liked him here, though.
Interesting.
I don't think he was necessarily the right choice for what they're trying to do here. Like,
yeah.
I don't think he could play a garbage man.
That's what I'm saying.
He would have been out of place in Men at Work.
Keith David would have stuffed him in a can immediately.
Like, sure.
Like, not even. He would not be joshing around while they're shooting the neighbors with the pellet gun. They're not getting.
Do you think they wrote this for Emilio Estevez?
See, Emilio Estevez could have absolutely played this role, and he would have done it with aplomb. Anyways, I like Modine in Shortcuts, right? In Shortcuts, Matthew Modine plays a yuppie shithead doctor whose wife hates him and is sleeping around with him, not because she wants to break up their marriage, but because she has this fucking undying rage at how much he's ignoring her.
Yeah, because he's eminently hateable.
Yeah, and he works really well there. And I don't know. I mean, I guess I just don't see him getting his hands dirty, man. That's the thing that really, and I think that that's like a fundamental part of this character that they're trying to sell on that with that Pearl Snap shirt, but it's just not working.
So we're talking about Matthew Modine, obviously, but there, you know, there are probably some people who don't know who he is.
Yeah.
So just to give a little breakdown, he was born in Loma Linda, California, and went to Mar Vista High in Imperial Beach down by San Diego. Mm. His first credit was in an ABC after-school special, Amy and the Angel, which starred Helen Slater, and also featured James Earl Jones and young Meg Ryan.
Is that the Angel Dust one? If it is, I've seen it.
No, I think it's actually a Guardian Angel. I think it's actually a Guardian Angel.
Okay, because the Angel Dust one.
I love Helen Slater, and she's directed episodes of SVU.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, his first film role was in John Sayles' first Hollywood film, Baby, It's You, which starred Patricia Arquette and also featured Tracy Pollan, Fisher Stevens, Robert Downey Jr., and Munch alums Vincent Spano and Joanna Merlin.
Yeah.
He quickly moved to the point where he was starring in movies, starring in Private School, Streamers, Birdie, Vision Quest, Full Fucking Metal Jacket, Married to the Mob, Gross Anatomy, Memphis Belle, Pacific Heights, Shortcuts, which is an ensemble film, but he's obviously still a big name at this point.
Yeah.
Bye Bye Love and Cutthroat Island before he sort of settled into more like supporting roles as men of his age tended to do around this time. He was nominated for an Emmy around this time, too, for his turn in And the Band Played On, one of those prestige HBO movies that no one watched. he was nominated for an Independent Spirit Award for Equinox, and that's sort of where, oddly, my sort of dislike of Matthew Modine comes in, and I've not seen the movie. It's a weird story that I'm not going to get into because I'm not 100% sure I have all the facts right, but anyway, he was also nominated for a Golden Globe for What the Deaf Man Heard, where he's playing a person who is acting like they're deaf and dumb, but are apparently not.
Interesting.
And then you kids might recognize him from Stranger Things.
Yeah.
That's what you would all recognize him from. He is also in Proof, some fucking show that was on recently, but I never watched. He is also in Weeds and The Dark Knight Rises in a bit part. So that's what people would probably recognize him from. I would posit that he's in a different level of fame than even John Hurd was, who we covered very recently.
Yeah.
He was a leading man in movies like Pacific Heights, which had a big media push. And
Full Metal Jacket, of course, is an iconic film. Sure. One of my least favorite Kubrick movies, but that doesn't matter.
You know, he's in a handful of Altman movies too, you know, like,
yeah.
But yeah, I'm kind of lukewarm on Full Metal Jacket.
I really don't like it. I don't get all the buzz about it. I love a lot of Stanley Kubrick movies, but it's not one that I'm that into.
I like the first half. I'm not wild about the second half.
Yeah.
I think the two halves are so separate from one another that it's not effective to me.
Yeah. And I think there's a lot of things you can shoot in England, and I don't know that Vietnam is one of those things that you can shoot there.
I will say that both Arlie Ermey and fucking Vincent D'Onofrio are fucking D'Onofrio amazing.
Is fucking amazing. Movie. But that's the part of the movie that's really good is the boot camp. And actually getting to Vietnam, I don't like it at all at that point.
Yeah, I don't think that's particularly effective. But
whatever. We're doesn't matter.
About a movie that, it doesn't matter.
But still, obviously, if you haven't seen it, it's one of those movies you got to see.
Yeah, you should watch it. But you should also just watch Shortcuts, you know?
Shortcuts is a movie that you should definitely see. Another great Robert Downey Jr. film. Really great. Yep. When he actually acted in movies and didn't just get paid to do some ADR work. Really great movie. I love that movie.
Now, moving down the line, I've got two actors to talk about because there's virtually no second. I know who you have.
I mean, she's not that interesting.
No. Okay, so First up, we've got Ann Petoniak. Mm-hmm. She is playing his sort of de facto aunt.
Yeah.
She did commercial acting after doing USO work with her husband back in war times. Then after she got divorced in her 50s, she decided to study at the Lee Strasberg Theater Institute and then became a resident actor at the acclaimed Actors Theater in Louisville.
Nice.
She was nominated for a Tony for Night Mother in 1984. At that point, I believe she was in her 60s then. So nice. she got a Tony nomination in her 60s. She was nominated again for a Tony in Picnic in 1994.
She was in Hiding Out? Fuck, I didn't look at her page.
Yes. As one might expect from someone whose credits don't really start until they're in their 60s, she plays a lot of grandmas and can be seen in Hiding Out, which was the first movie I chose from her list because I told John Cryer in person that I had just seen Hiding Out and he apologized for it. She's also in Unfaithful, A Thousand Acres, and V.I. Warshawski.
Yeah, so, nice.
Now, the one that I'm sure Adam wanted me to talk about is Michelle Santopietro, who's playing Linda Cusick. She skipped a bunch of grades growing up because she was gifted. Mm. Her IMDb bio is clearly written by her agent.
Yeah. Or her mom.
She went to Tisch for drama. That's obviously the NYU drama school.
Yeah.
She went to Tisch for drama and clinical psychology. Mm. She's recognizable to Adam for having played JoJo Palmese.
Not really, though. Not really, because I was like, who is that woman? I vaguely remember this character, but
she's in four episodes of The Sopranos.
Yeah, exactly.
She did a ton of stage work and has done improv at the New York and Boston comedy clubs in New York. Mm. Also, she starred in The Donner Party, which is streamable on IMDb.tv, with Crispin Glover and Clayne Crawford, which is a twosome that would pretty much get me to watch any movie.
Especially when they're eating people, which is, I assume, what they're doing.
Presumably. And she was also in American Violence from like a couple years back with Bruce Dern, Denise Richards, Columbus Short, Michael Paré, Rob Gronkowski,
weird,
Stipe Miocic, and Munch alums Johnny Mesner from fucking last week's episode and Nick Chinland.
Weird. So, yeah, from the episode that's kind of most similar to this episode. Weird.
Yes. There are virtually no guest stars in this episode. It's really a Modine fest.
Yeah, it sure is.
Now, I should say Jackie threw out an alternative Dick Wolf that was just... That's intense, Stabler. I'm ready to get into notes if you are.
I'm ready.
I don't think this is going to take very long.
I don't have that many notes because there's not that much box ticking that goes on for what we watch these episodes for. And yeah, I don't have anything particular to talk about. I looked up the couple addresses that were either mentioned or kind of alluded to. Nothing too exciting. The addresses sort of exist.
I have to say I kind of dug the unconventional open where Stabler's prepping interrogation with like his low rent DIY NYPD psyops.
Yeah.
while we get like off screen chatter from Modine equating to what is essentially VO, much like in the last episode where we sort of had off screen dialogue over action.
It's strange to have like perp narration going on, right? Like where we're kind of getting into this from the perp's perspective is a very strange kind of frame for it.
Yeah, but given what follows, it makes sense because, you know, this episode's very much just pitting Stabler against his analog if he didn't have anything tethering him to polite society, you know?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
I'm not saying that Stabler would be raping and murdering young girls, but the rage issues for sure.
Yeah, that's definitely like bubbling up under the surface with Stabler is how he's...
Yeah, through through the whole episode.
Yeah.
And, you know, explodes into a into a bunch of lockers.
Yeah.
Yeah. My next note is, I don't know that I understand Modine's getup.
He's wearing a fairly stylish jean jacket with jeans and a pearl snap Western wear shirt. He looks like he should have a handlebar mustache, or at least one of those haircuts where it's beard with shaved sides kind of look. You know what I'm talking about? Like the beard fash look.
Yeah.
That's the outfit he's wearing, but not...
To me, he looks like he should be an asshole dancing at the White Horse.
Yes, absolutely. The White Horse Tavern in Austin.
Which means nothing to anyone listening.
But guys, as I was describing, would be those assholes dancing at the White Horse. So it is apropos.
Yeah. It's a Western swing bar in Austin on the east side that smells like piss.
Mm-hmm, it does.
Is insanely loud, is terribly set up, and I hate it.
I hate that bar, but there was a great taco truck that used to be parked out front of it. So I would go over there for tacos, even though I did not like that establishment.
Oh, by the way, you know, having just spent a week in Austin.
You don't recognize it anymore, do you, Josh?
No, Austin's dead. I've been there like 2 years ago, but like we went to the Liberty. Holy fuck. Have you been down East 6?
No. I've not been down East 6 in like a decade, Josh. Like a really long time.
Okay, the Liberty has condos on the lots right next to it, built up to where it's like four-story condos right next to it overlooking it. And like all the condos in Austin look are fucking horrible. Yeah,
they look like they're going to fall down in 2 weeks is what they look like.
Every fucking one of them seems to just have bullshit light-colored stonework with dumb fucking colored accent columns. It's fucking abysmal.
Austin is just bulldozing everything down and putting up, you know, this crap in between.
It's awful.
You lived there longer than I did, so for you it's probably shocking because now you're far enough away from it that
I only lived there for 12 years.
I know, but more like I moved away before.
I lived there more recently.
That's what I'm saying. And you probably haven't been back quite as many times, but going back, because I was working in Austin for a while after I moved to Galveston. And so I kind of stopped being able to do that much because I was there for such a short amount of time and our job was so physically exhausting that I just would like drink beer and cry in the shower basically most of the time afterwards.
But how's that different from any exactly. other job?
But seeing it go from like this place that I love to something that like, man, I don't even know. I don't want to go out. Fuck this place. But I've been there for a while.
It's pretty depressing.
Yeah, I 100% agree. But back to the show, Josh.
So
Matthew Modine also is complaining about a place that he lived for a while. But in this case, it was California because it was too hot there.
From his conversation with Munch, I think he was in the San Fernando Valley.
Mm. Yeah, that makes sense.
Because Munch he wants to move to the beautiful San Fernando Valley. And it seems like they're all needling him, trying to like elicit information from him. Actionable information.
So I know that this episode was clearly like fishing for Emmy noms for both Modine and Maloney, but in my mind, the star of the show is fucking Belzer. This might be the best Belzer we've seen. His my high school basketball coach said I look like a retarded gazelle with a spastic disorder. His whole talk
we
about
we did not write that. That was in
the episode.
To be 100% clear, that is not us saying
You know, and he's trying to get a rise out of Matthew Modine. Mm-hmm. He also goes on this whole thing about the San Fernando Valley. There's a joie de vivre about Munch that we don't often get to see because usually the Munch episodes we've watched are fairly kind of drab, depressing affairs about his ex-wives. I really liked it for that.
I think it's really weird that he wants to move to the beautiful San Fernando Valley, though.
Because when I think about moving to California, what I think about is Encino, Josh. I think about endless suburbs and freeways.
Encino's actually all right.
Okay, I don't know my San Fernando Valley geography that well.
I mean, it is in the valley. Encino's like tucked into the hills, you know?
It's right down there.
I think you're thinking of Reseda or Panorama City. The north side of the Hollywood Hills, you know, that are form the north side of the Santa Monica Mountains.
I imagine you've got close access to beaches and hills and...
Yeah.
And you've got great films that have been made there, like Encino Man.
Mm-hmm. I believe that won the Oscar.
I'm just kind of going to bounce around here. When Liv shows him the photos of the crime scenes, it's a classic SVU non-consensual second unit nudity.
Sure.
There's like a bound girl in the mud. Mm-hmm. We're seeing a lot of skin, obviously, for a very brief amount of time, and it's in a photograph, so you kind of have to pause it to really see it. But it's pretty classic SVU work right there.
You can't call it suggestive because it's all right there.
Yeah.
Right around this time, we also get Cragen dressing down Stabler to sort of like establish the ticking clock, like locked room scenario.
Oh, God. Yeah.
But I think that's sort of effective because, you know, it's like character-based exposition and setup, but it doesn't really feel like it is.
I'm ogotting the ticking clock frame for this because it's weird to see those clock cards to me because it's not something we see often. In fact, the only time I can remember anything quite like it was the Nick Chinland episode.
Execution.
Yeah, execution. So, go ahead. You were going to say you didn't mind it.
It's a little weird because all of it means nothing, ultimately.
Yeah.
Like, that's the weird thing to me.
Yeah.
Like, with execution,
the cold open sets us up for this, for the, having this resolution where Wong's going to get thrown against the wall again, and we find out why.
But with execution, the ticking clock, there is a finite, like, if shit does not get resolved, this fucker's dying. Mm-hmm. So, the ticking clock makes a little more sense there. At least, well, not to say that it doesn't make sense here, but it doesn't bear any fruit here.
No, exactly.
I mean, it sort of does, but through police work that they should have been doing anyway.
Exactly. That in any other episode, they would have done this police work without having us have to sit through 24 hours worth of interrogation.
Sure. So, he's got a pigtails kink.
He sure does.
That's weird. I will say the tight shot of Modine whistling is fucking pornographic.
It's disgusting.
So gross. Man, it is. It's...
Yeah, Matthew Modine should never whistle again. He should be banned.
Certainly not with a camera, like, in his business. It is... It's fucked. I kind of wish they just kept asking him about states. How does Delaware make you feel, Gordon?
Arizona. What about Arizona?
Does Nebraska get your rocks off, Gordy?
In the sand hills of old Nebraska, that's where the tall corn grows. There's a little girl awaiting. Cuckold birds are so many. Among the sunflowers I long to roam. In the sand hills of old Nebraska, that's my home, sweet home.
I was not expecting his freak out about killing kids' puppies. I was not expecting that. That really did kind of hit me from left field.
Why is that, Gordon? Why are people always disrespecting you?
I don't know.
How can you take it?
I'm not going to take it anymore. They don't know.
I don't know anything about it.
That's right. I'm going to show them.
You're going to show them, aren't you?
Yeah.
Who?
Everybody.
Yeah, because no one's innocent. Your bosses.
That's right.
Your girlfriends.
Yeah.
The kids.
Even the kids!
What are you going to do to them?
I'm going
to
hurt the kids! Hurt your kids, Stabler!
You're talking about Carrie Lynn Palmer.
I'm going to kill all the kids. What are you going to do about it, huh?
Tell me how you killed
them. And then I'm going to kill their puppies, and I'm going to kill their kitties. I'm a psycho killer. What are you going to do about it, huh? Come on. Come on. I'm a psycho killer. What are you going to do about it, huh? What are you going to do? Come on. Come on.
I didn't buy it, but
I will say this is a weird, like, again, I'm not really much of a Modine fan.
Yeah.
But Modine going off the rails and then pulling back and making it look like it was all for show to get Stabler's goat kind of works for me here.
It was not bad. It worked.
Yeah. It's really just the miscasting him as blue collar fucking.
Yeah. I don't know. I think it's less than blue collar thing. Like, obviously I think that's a problem, but also I think that.
He's doing some weird accent work, and it's an unplaceable accent.
I just think that there's some people, like Maloney does this pretty well, where, like, you feel like he could snap a lot of times, right?
Sure.
And sure. I think that Modine does kind of snap in that scene, and I think he does a good job. But I think outside of that scene, I don't really see him as just like the bubbling over with rage kind of character. Like, I kind of bought that with Nick Chinlund a little bit more than I buy it with Modine.
Well, I bought it from Nick Chinlund because I just saw him, you know, in that race car episode of Red Shoe Diaries. So,
which, I mean, Modine totally should have been in a Red Shoe Diaries. He was built for that, but he was too big.
He missed his call. He missed his calling.
He was too big for it. He Hollywooded them.
I think the rapid fire interrogation is like written and paced well.
Yeah.
Like, there's a real rhythm to the proceedings, and you know, they're constantly going around the room and making you feel like you're in it. And if you were him, and since they use the weird construct of him doing the VO in the beginning, that sort of puts you in his head a little bit more than you normally would be with a Vic or with a suspect.
Yeah. And I like the, you know, with Benson bringing in the boxes with the documents, and then we're thinking the whole time, like, what's in the boxes? What's she gonna pull out of the boxes? Yeah, you're right. There's
Gwyneth Paltrow's head.
Oh, what's in the box?
Not till you give me the
what's
gun.
In the fucking box?
Give me the gun.
And I thought Hargate was great. The whole
can't ever, wait ever to drop she what's in the box in here.
Killing puppies, man.
Okay, that's quite the scar on Rickett's arm.
Yeah.
Stabler defenestrated him, and and he wouldn't sue the city. You know, he's a man. He's 40.
I'm a man. I'm 40.
I know. I didn't cry about it. I didn't ask for a handout. I didn't sue the city like all the other schmucks. Like, come on, man. If a cop throws me through a fucking plate glass window, you gotta sue. What are you doing, man? I thought Finn was also great in this episode. Every scene he was in was fantastic. I love the beginning, you know, where you kind of don't know that that's Finn, but you maybe suspect it. Where Modine's,
I knew it was him. I knew it was him doing deep voice.
But I still liked it. And then I like it when he comes
back. Yeah, no, it was
fun. Yeah.
And I love when he comes in and he's like, what's going on here?
Yeah.
I have a note. Stabler knows this guy because he is this guy.
Yeah.
Then at first I assumed Stabler was ordering pizza for some reason. But then when I was looking at the food the second time, because, you know, the first time I was writing the recap.
Yeah.
The second time, it's like, are those sandwiches or is that Greek food?
I think it was Greek food. It was something like that.
Yeah. It looked like it was sort of like a shawarma and a pita or something like that.
Yeah. It did look like, they call them gyro. It looked like a gyro.
It's a gyro.
Yeah. They call them gyros in New York, Josh. People give you dirty looks if you call it a gyro.
There are plenty of New Yorkers who still refer to anyone who speaks Spanish, regardless of where they're from, as Spanish.
I think that's only.
So I don't think we should be looking to New. I don't think we should be looking to New York for any of that. Any
pronunciation tips?
What should we call this thing? Yeah.
I love how much SVU loves food torture in interrogation sequences, because this is at least the third.
Streetwise for sure.
Was heavily a food torture thing. And here they're doing it too.
Oh, you want this pizza? This pizza's great if you tell me shit up.
We're bringing extra senses into the scene here because Elliot's like,
you're smelling a lot of raw onions.
Yeah, Elliot's like, extra raw onions. Put everything on
double
it. Stinks.
Double the raw onions.
And so at that point, I'm really forced to think about the sputum that is coming out of Elliot's mouth. And he is close to Modine.
Well, and he full-on spits in his face.
Yeah. And we're talking like this is indoors during the Delta variant spike. It is definitely extra horror these days, guys. Yeah. You know, keep your masks on, at least for the time being.
I'll be wearing my mask in the movie theater watching Fast 9 tomorrow.
Yeah, well, that'll be fun.
It will be. We get some more Finn nap time in this episode. Which, gotta say, I love it.
I also like that we get to see Finn, like, long-haired Finn down. Is that correct? Am I remembering this all correctly?
I feel like it was pulled back, but I might be lying.
No, but in the initial scene, because he combed it out and it was down, which is something we don't really ever get to see, because usually he's got that, like, tight pullback thing going on as professional look. So a nice little iced tea hair note.
Now, Stabler says he knows what he's doing, but given that the 24 hours come and go without an arrest.
Yep.
Does he?
It seems like the plan was that Elliot was going to scream at him all day and then that, yeah. and then uh-huh. hope that magic would uh-huh. happen, which it does, as it always does.
But like they only break things after he leaves and then they have to do actual police work.
Yeah, exactly. He leaves and then they go to Old Town Road and they break the case open.
Yeah, that's what happens. Thanks, little Nas X. Yeah. Now, also, let's be honest, if they weren't coincidentally at the aunt's house, they would have also had another dead kid on their hands as a direct result of setting him off again with their question.
Exactly. They have to take a step back every time they take a step forward, Josh. That's the SVU way. Did you notice how much Elliot was waxing poetic about pedophiles?
Yeah. Like, you know, they just want to help out. You know?
They just, they love those kids. They-
but you... okay, I don't have the energy to do this, but the bitch count in this one is fucking off the charts.
Yeah, I did not go through. I should have. I did not think about that. But yeah, they said it a lot.
It's absurd.
Yeah.
And, you know, with that, there's the sort of latent misogyny in I know you're doing it for effect.
Absolutely.
To try to elicit the response
from a guy
from a misogynist.
Yeah.
But it's wild how much they're saying bitch in this.
It's true.
I would be shocked if they didn't say it at least 20 times.
And it's another one of those things like how I don't know how standard and practice work, but I assume that there was like a level.
There's got to be a count.
Yeah, right. There's got to be a count. And maybe it's a context each time and they could wave away the context because it's like they're trying to break this guy and he's a bad guy and blah, blah, blah. I don't know. But you're right. That was definitely noticeable.
It's jarring. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously I do some writing and I pretty much never write that.
Yeah. But you're not Quentin Tarantino. You're not really working in the language of the street, Josh. Just kidding. Yeah, there's a lot of things you shouldn't write, and it's okay if you don't. Yeah. You can be creative and figure out other ways to come with the same effect.
I definitely find plenty of ways to write terrible things.
Yeah, absolutely.
I just don't need to like pepper in misogyny in all of it.
Yeah, and Gordon was not taking care of his aunt's house, man.
No.
That looked like a beautiful home over there.
It looked like it had been a beautiful
home. Yeah, at one point, and he let that thing go to absolute shit.
It's really weird how long they make us linger on Stabler having spit in his face. Like, that spit is on Modine's forehead. And they probably had to do multiple takes.
Do you think they let him wipe off in between, or they just leave it there? They're like, no, we like the loogie. Just
No, for continuity. I do have to say, I really liked the scene where Stabler breaks down who Gordon is. Mm-hmm. Then the tables get turned and Gordon says he sees himself in Stabler and that the only difference is that he has others controlling him, that Stabler does.
Yeah.
I think that scene's really good. They've sort of come to a detente. Nothing's going to get solved in the room and they sort of like all airs are put aside.
And we know this about Elliot, right? This is the source of his problems at home. This is, you know.
But this is Stabler having to like sort of come to terms with it in the moment.
Uh-huh.
And I think it really works.
I think they go a little over the top when they're in the aunt's house and Elliot's gun shaking and they just like leave the frame on the gun shaking for a little longer than they needed to for the effect.
Sure. But Maloney is nothing if not a craftsman and he probably drank like 47 cups of coffee to get there. Now, I know it was for dramatic effect, but Rickett getting released, forcing them to regroup. Was sort of dumb.
Well, I mean, they had to release him.
No. But someone should have been doing this police work anyway. Munch could have been doing some of it. Finn could have been doing some of it. Yeah. Did all of them really need to be in there pressing him in interrogation?
I understand why they couldn't keep him locked up, but that doesn't mean that they couldn't keep him under at least surveillance. why wasn't Finn following him around in a car or something,
right?
Or somebody else? Because it seems like the natural effect of having Elliot tick all the boxes for 24 hours is to set him off and
sure,
you know, have him go to where he goes, which is to try to rape a 12-year-old girl.
Yes. And you know, as one does, I guess.
And then presumably murder them and beat up the body post-mortem, yeah, and then dump it in a marsh somewhere.
Or in the East River.
Yeah.
So Benson wings him, so Elliot can't execute him.
Yeah.
Stabler really gets to go to some dark places in this one.
Yeah. The last 10 minutes of the episode is basically Elliot confronting his demons, and usually with his fists.
But I think if we know anything about him now, we know that I'm just going to go home is code for I'm just going to go destroy our lockers.
Well, he destroyed his fucking hands. He probably needs to go to the hospital after that. He probably broke.
Nah, he's tough.
Oh, man. He fucking broke a couple carpals.
Tarsals.
Yeah.
Tarsals are your feet.
Tarsals are your feet. Carpals are your...
Carpals are your hands.
Yeah.
And phalanges.
Yeah. Broke that shit, man.
I'm out of notes.
I'm out of notes too, Josh. Elliot beats the shit out of the lockers. His knuckles are bloody. He's crying. And scene... And so every week we rank these and we are trying to fit every episode we watch into a list where we can judge them against all the other ones. And we do that here at Munch My Benson with a composite score system. We used a 10-point scale for 4 different criteria. And so we measure it on quality, the guests, how problematic it was, and the depth and breadth of lives ruined. And this is one of those ones that's going to be kind of hard to fit into the canon because it is so weird.
Yeah, it's very strange.
You know, it is just so weird to have 2 actors sitting in a room for really close to a half an hour is basically, yep, Elliot and Modine going back and forth with maybe a little bit of somebody else being there, but not much.
But I mean, there are full acts where it's entirely in the interrogation room.
Yeah, and there's at least one act where it's just the two of them. Nobody else is, yep, even in there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's different than we are used to.
It's pretty wild.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm watching an episode of Hannibal.
Yeah, exactly. It's something, it's a, yeah, different show. I don't know how compelling it is. I think it's pretty good, but it kind of feels like it takes a long time, is my problem with it. It kind of drags. And maybe I'm just, I saw Matthew Modine and I kind of groaned a little bit because, well, I've liked him in certain roles.
Well, that was a groan of orgiastic ecstasy, right? Because you'd been edging down the stairs.
I've been edging down the stairs and thinking about his fucking blank, yuppie prick face. That's, yeah, what I've been thinking about.
You've seen Pacific Heights too many times.
Yeah.
That's your problem.
There's this argument between Modine and Julianne Moore in Shortcuts that is just seared into my memory because Julianne Moore is shirt cocking, as Josh and I would call it. She is,
yep,
Donald Ducking it, as some other people might call it.
I think it's shirt pussing.
Yeah, in this case, shirt pussing. And I mean, in this case, it is like fire crotching.
Yeah, because this is early 90s. Scaping,
yeah,
of either gender was not a thing then.
And it's effective in this case because this scene, this is one of the least erotic nude scenes that I've ever, yep, seen.
Yeah.
She is absolutely fucking pissed at him. And you see him, and I don't even remember what he did, but you're like, yeah, get pissed at that guy. He obviously sucks.
Well, he Modine.
He obviously sucks. But yeah. It's a great scene. It's mostly Julianne Moore carrying it, but you know, Modine is definitely, you understand why she hates him, if I recall correctly.
I have some weird feelings about Julianne Moore too. But
yeah, in that movie, she is fantastic. I agree with you.
She's only good when she's playing herself.
I'm not 100% on board, but I think she is great in that role.
If asked to stretch at all, she cannot.
Now, what we've been beating around the bush, so to speak, is, was this a good episode? I don't even know. It's not bad.
I think the pacing in the interrogation is really fucking rock solid.
They're doing something different, and it's not horrible.
Uh-huh.
I don't love it, right? Like, I don't...
No. It's not like the last episode where they're doing something different and it fucking totally works. And
yeah.
It's, you know, like a 9 quality.
Yeah.
I think my initial inclination is to say 6 or 7, and I would probably go 7 because it is doing something different.
It's reaching... It's really good Elliot character development. It really works there. And it's not a miss. It's reaching a lot and it's not a complete miss. Like, execution was kind of a complete miss because
yes.
Certain things about it just didn't make any sense. And Shinland was not really the best. It just didn't work the same way that this one did.
Right.
And we'll call it a 7. I don't know that it necessarily ticks the other boxes quite as well, yeah. But that one definitely does. Now, Modine is the only guest worth talking about.
Sure.
He's doing a lot.
I think this could be either like a 3 or a 7. I don't know.
I was going to call it a 5 because I think he's doing a lot.
He's doing a lot.
It's not a complete miss, but it's also not a complete hit. And there's nobody else to carry it besides Modine.
He gets a ton of screen time, and I think I think there are the scenes where he seems to freak out and then pulls back, and it seems like he's kind of maybe fucking with them.
And it works, yeah.
I think those work.
I think so, too. I think that the whistling thing is...
I don't know what the whistling thing is. It's one of... You can't even tell what he's whistling either. Like, you know, whistle that fucking Daisy song that Hal is... Whistle that.
Or like a nursery rhyme or something because he likes little kids. I don't know.
Yeah, or the farmer in the dell.
Yeah.
You know, just take a page from the Book of Omar.
Yeah.
But I think the freak out scenes are enough to get it over just the 5 and have it be a 6.
Okay, we can call it a 6 because also, like, so much of the episode is just Modine's shit-eating grin sitting there. Anyways, okay.
But he's having to smell a lot of onions.
He is having to smell a lot of onions. And I would say the most problematic stuff in this episode, okay, we see a naked child that's been tied up and beaten and left for dead, but we only see that briefly.
But what episode don't we see that?
Yeah. But I really think that Elliot's food torture is probably the most problematic thing.
Well,
spit on Modine's forehead.
Yeah, we really have to dwell on that spit on his head. You know, like we're there for a while.
So give me a number, Josh.
Oh, there's also pigtail kink.
The pigtail, there is.
Yeah, there's a lot of pigtail kink.
Surprised that our prison guard in the last episode didn't have a pigtails.org.
Yeah. Oh, there's also the weird, you know, Stabler sort of like pedophiles. They like to help.
Yeah, Stabler's pro-pedophile rant. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you have to do some gymnastics to get to it being pro-pedophile, but pro-pedophile versus, like, annihilator of tweens.
What was the one that we saw that had the pro-pedophilia rant where Elliot was undercover in glasses?
That one's so good.
That was also the one where they went to the Orioles Cuban national team game. What the fuck
wasn't
was
that? Also, wasn't that a granny panty one too?
That was the great granny panty hustle. That's exactly what it was. That's right, which was...
118, I think. 118 chat room.
Chat room, that's what it was. Yeah, chat room was bonkers and fun, but did have a couple decidedly pro-pedophilia rants. So it kind of reminds us of that. So beating around the bush, was this problematic? And if so, where do you rank this?
I mean, it's obviously somewhat problematic. You know, we're left to think about a lot of fucking tween girl victims.
Mm-hmm. We see one.
Him only being able to get off with pigtails with adult women.
We think a lot about his life in California. Yeah.
I can't tell if Munch is shitting on the entire San Fernando Valley or not.
Belzer doesn't care for godless Americana like that.
This episode also comes down very clearly in the pro not suing the city if a cop defenestrates you camp.
Well, that's in keeping with the kind of pro cop bent of this show.
It's not manly to sue the city if a cop throws you through a plate glass window and fucking gives you a fucking like a foot long scar on your arm.
A real man gets an arterial bleed from the cops and doesn't complain about it.
Yeah.
What, 4? What do you think? This is a 4? Or do you think this is above average?
I think it's a 4.
I mean, I think it is problematic, but not like the last episode.
No. Not like the last episode. We're not forced to think about Modine's dong and the moles on it.
Yeah, we're not. Exactly.
There aren't multiple scenes in which that dong is just out of frame.
Or there's not multiple sets of genitals barely out of frame, artfully out of frame.
Yeah. I would say coyly with the instance of Hassan Johnson.
Yeah. So depth and breadth of lives ruined now. We have at least two victims. We have a third near victim.
Well, they're
I didn't do the count. I watched
He raped the 14-year-old daughter. He killed the girl in New York. He killed the girl in Nevada. He killed the girl in Arizona. And he killed the second girl in New York. So there are five dead, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Five dead and one. Maybe he just attempted the rape of the girlfriend's daughter in California, but I don't think so.
It seemed like it was rape, or at least close enough.
And another kidnapping victim.
Yeah.
Certainly.
Kidnapping victim. Also, his aunt is kind of a victim too. Her house has lost basically all of its value because of his mistreatment of it, and not the same level as being raped and murdered, but still kind of sucks, obviously.
We've got two cars down the drain.
We've got Stabler's family life, obviously.
And mental health.
Yeah, mental health. All those things are at least bubbling under the surface as being results of this.
I think whenever we're dealing with internalized long-term, not quite trauma in this case, but definitely some things he's going to have to deal with. Whenever you're dealing with that with a main character, I think that sort of ups it a little more.
Yeah, absolutely. And we've got Munch. His dreams of sunny suburbia are somewhat quashed, I think, in this one. So you got a number.
The San Fernando Valley is too hot. It is too hot. It's fucking hot as fuck.
Honestly, I don't understand the San Fernando Valley. There's a lot that I think if you look at the history of Los Angeles through the frame of, oh, it's that way because of racism, it makes a lot more sense. And that's the only reason that the San Fernando Valley makes any sense to me, because why on earth would you fucking want to live there? That's my rant.
I'll say I work in the Valley a lot. There's a lot to like about the Valley.
Okay, fine. But
I didn't live there, and it seems like it would be hard to live there. But, you know, Studio City wouldn't be that bad. Southern parts of North Hollywood wouldn't be that bad. Toluca Lake, which is my street name.
Yeah.
That wouldn't be that bad to live either.
Okay. Well, that's you're talking about like the close-in urban part, right? That's probably nice.
Right. Yeah. I'm not.
Yeah.
For me, I'm not saying that other people living in like West Hills or fucking Pacoima or Sylmar, I'm not saying that you couldn't live there and have an okay life, but
that's a lot of places
too far for me to potentially have to drive to work
for what your job had been.
Yeah.
All right. So give me a number. Depth and breadth.
There are five fucking bodies.
There are. Has to be above average, right?
I'm inclined to say seven.
Okay. We'll go.
Because it would be a six, but with the Stabler wrinkle, I think it's seven.
So that puts this episode as a six, which is above average. If it was just me, I probably would have ranked it a little bit lower, but maybe I just wasn't watching this with the open mind that I would have had I watched it twice. I just watched it once, and when I watched it, I kind of groaned because I'm like, oh, fuck, it's this episode. I remember this one. But I honestly...
I didn't remember it at all. I have a pretty fucking good memory, and I've thankfully purged so many of these episodes from my memory because there are fucking 500 of them.
Yeah.
To where, like...
There's a lot that I've forgotten.
Yeah.
But this one in particular is like, oh, shit, it's the one with Matthew Modine sitting in a room the whole time. I remember this one.
Sure.
And I think that colored my judgment of it. Again, I only watched it once. So I'm glad we have multiple voices here, because you're right. It was doing something
way different.
Way different. And it really didn't miss that badly. Yeah. Like, it really was actually pretty well done. And
I mean, it was clearly going for a 10. It didn't get there.
Yeah.
For overall quality, you know, it was clearly going for that. And yeah, it wasn't there. But
so we have a couple other sixes. The Timothy Busfield Russian Brides. It was a beige turtleneck, so it really made him look like a human penis. That was another six. And Staten Island Has Its Own Entire Language. That was Remorse. The Christopher Evan Welch, Jennifer Esposito episode. That was yet another six. Obviously getting there in different ways. All of them they kind of do when they're in the kind of middle range. I kind of liked it in the same ways that those were. Those were different ones. You know, it's interesting. There's certain ones that just we never even talk about ever again. And there are other ones that we talk about a lot. So it's interesting how that comes back.
I really like being able to look at an episode and have no idea what it was by the episode name.
By our episode name of it?
No, by the other one. Actually, I understand what it was about because I know what I like. If I look at our episode name, I get it. But there'll be episodes where it's like Melancholy Pursuit. What the fuck was that?
Yeah, Rockabye. No idea what that one was.
Yeah, Turmoil. I mean, that could be every episode.
Yeah, Hooker's Chips and Donuts. I remember that one.
Yeah.
And because this was a season 6 episode, I just want to pour one out for episode 2 of Munch My Benson that was Haunted, which was also from season 6. That was Hot Mike Sandoval Came In Through the Back Door, which honestly,
great name.
Great. Really fun.
By chance, too. Like, that was totally taken out of context, but
a fun episode. And we criminally underrated it because we gave it a quality of a 1, and it was so much fun. So sorry, Hot Mike Sandoval. That was a fun one. But Josh, I think it's time to roll another episode and go to bed. It's late for me.
Yeah, it is. All right. So going over to episode.lol, which is fueled by Friend of the Pod Flat. I am clicking the pick a random episode button. Yeah, Bill and Ted, you know. Yeah. They're not exactly enthused to be
the good robots are over there, the bad robots are over here.
Oh, I hate that part.
And we've got Informed. Season 8, episode 1. Benson is called in after a young woman shows up at the hospital, raped and beaten with her head shaved. Haley Kearns refuses to submit to a rape kit, but Benson steals her underwear before leaving the apartment and gives it to Warner to check out. When Benson returns to her apartment, she encounters Morrison, who admits that Haley is a federal informant working with them on eco-terrorism.
Uh-oh.
So, this is the Mariska Hargitay is pregnant episode.
Yeah.
Super pregnant. This one features Marcia Gay Harden.
Oh, God.
Very centrally as she is Morrison. It's also got Eben Moss Bachrock from Girls.
Yeah.
Everyone would recognize him from that, amongst other things. He was in some other stuff, too.
I have kind of a no Dunham policy, so I did not watch Girls. So, I do not recognize him from that.
Cool. there are a lot of other guest stars named here. I don't recognize any other names. That's not to say they are not of note.
This one was referenced in Undercover, the one we watched last week.
Yes, it was.
Because they talked about Benson going undercover, but this wasn't.
Let me make sure this is not a two-parter.
It might be.
Because it could be.
Mm-hmm.
This is definitely the episode they used to get her out of the unit for a while. The next episode's Clock, and that's not related, so.
Yeah. Well, we already watched that one.
Yep. So this is another weird, like, it's an episode that people remember.
Mm-hmm. I'm getting the Benson ones. You've been getting the Maloney ones. So it'll be interesting. But yeah, guys, let's munch some Bensons. Let's rate and review the podcast and support other independent podcasters while you're...
Yeah, listen to Fuck My Work Life, listen to Neatcast, listen to Drunk Theory, listen to whatever fucking ones, and rate and review them too, because they're the ones who actually need your help, not the big fucking massive podcasts that have fucking hundreds and if not thousands of reviews on Apple Podcasts.
Absolutely.
But yeah, first rate this one because you just fucking listen to it.
Yeah, and keep on munching, guys.
You know what? Munch everyone's Benson.
Ah, here we go. Classifieds. Single white male. Wanted for my wife's playmate. Prefer hedonist who likes pleasure mixed with pain. I get to watch. This could develop into something really meaningful for you. Didn't somebody tell me that you live in California for a while? Nuts to come back to this city. In a few years when I get my pension, meager though it is, I'm heading straight to the beautiful San Fernando Valley, live the sweet life. I can't believe you came back. Why did you? You have a girlfriend in California, Mr. Rickett?
I don't feel like chatting anymore, friend.
I hear you. Might as well wait till we get started. Plus, it'll give you more time to come up with an answer. Detective Olivia Benson, Gordon Rickett. Where's your partner?
Just taking care of a few things.
We're just going over the classifieds, trying to help out Mr. Rickett with his sex life. He's very open-minded.